Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday, the 16th of March, or as we call it in our house, the day before the big one. St. Patrick's Day. So we're very excited. It's a very nice day. Even though the weather kind of stinks, we're very excited to talk to our wonderful panel this morning. I'll tell you, I wasn't out a lot this weekend. I was home most of the weekend, but I was out once or twice. And every time I went out, people were just so nice telling me about the panel and how much they appreciate our panelists and our conversations and the program. And I just thank you to all those people. And it was just really gratifying to hear. We've worked very hard over the last couple of weeks, as we do every day, but certainly over the last couple of weeks, in trying to have these conversations that enlighten what's going on in our world that is complicated. So I just want to thank those people, and it was very, very sweet. I wasn't out a bunch because I'm in the process of passing a kidney stone.
Oh my, is that fun?
I'm having fun. So that started about Friday afternoon, so I was in the
Friday the 13th.
That's a good point. Okay, I had not put that dot together. Connected that dot. Well, I went to the emergency room, and they pretty much say, you know, unless this or this is happening, you're just going to be miserable. And I said, well, should I go to work? And they said, well, you can be miserable at home or you can be miserable at work. And so I saw no reason not to share it with you, the whole listener.
Are you in pain right now?
I'm better now than I was yesterday. I felt like I was being shanked in the flank, both inside and out. And was writhing in pain. And
interestingly enough, it was the Ides of March.
You're making these connections.
It's all making sense.
And tomorrow,
what are you going to do tomorrow?
Exactly
as a leprechaun?
Caesar felt.
Caesar had it easy compared to a kidney stone.
So, you know, you and Caesar now.
In fairness, you know, me curled up in the fetal position at home isn't like incredibly rare, but I mean, I work on this show and talk about the news of the day, and after reading the papers, I tend to take that position. But so I'm looking forward to that to pass. And
no pun intended.
No pun intended.
And, no, and I guess you are.
I'm absolutely waiting for it to pass, and I'll report back to you on the. On the weight and the gender, and once I deliver this, I'll let you know how it all turns out.
I applaud you can have a sense of humor
about
this.
You know, I haven't had one in 30 years.
I'm not saying a word.
In 30 years. And the last, I did have some kidney issues, but they went in and they just took them out and there was no pain involved. But I did have a kidney stone attack like 30 years ago. So, and what I find interesting is I remember everything about that moment. So here we go. Couple of quick housekeeping announcements that I would like to mention while I have you all here before we go off and talk about the news with our wonderful group. First of all, this morning at 11 o'clock, we will celebrate once again every once a week. We are trying to air a Women's History Special, and we're going to do so this morning. Afropop Worldwide, which is one of our most popular programs and has been so on this network for decades, and they have a Afropop Worldwide celebration of women's history, and we're going to be playing that program this morning at 11 o'clock with the dominance of women in African diaspora music palpable. They have a very good program that they put together in celebration of women and world music, and we will play that for you at 11 o'clock.
I just want to say that
That is really a fantastic show, number one. Number two, the host of that show has the best accent and radio voice.
Isn't it great?
And Joey, yours is great, too. But
no, not
but
that good.
That is really, yeah. It's a fantastic show, and they've been doing it for a long time.
It's very well done, yeah. And we're honored to air the program this morning. Tomorrow, for you 90s grunge fans, how many are in this room right now? That's what I thought. Our dear friend Melissa Ofdemauer, who was the bassist for the band Hole with Courtney Love, as well as for Smashing Pumpkins, and from Montreal, Canada, and now is the curator and founder of Basilica Hudson in Hudson, New York. She has written the most stunning memoir that I have read in a very long time. It's called Even the Good Girls Will Cry, a 90s rock memoir. Hmm. She is a superb writer. She is a beautiful, beautiful writer. And she makes this time, it's a heartbreaking book. There's a lot of addiction and anger and rage that is around her. And how she deals with it is just stunning, and she tells the story. So tomorrow, the 17th, is her birthday. It is also the release date for her book, and she will be with us also to honor women's history. She will be with us for the full hour at 11 o'clock tomorrow. It is a great conversation that I had with her, and we are looking forward to presenting that to you. Finally, in our 11 o'clock specials on Friday, we are going to welcome Dr. Ibram X. Kendi, who you may know as the author of the New York Times bestseller Stamped from the Beginning. He is the winner of the National Book Award, and he has a new book out called Chain of Ideas, The Origins of Our Authoritarian Age. And in this book, he talks about how the Great Replacement Theory has moved from the margins to become the most, what he believes, dominant political theory of our time. We will talk to Dr. Kendi coming up on Friday. This book also comes out tomorrow, but he will be with us for the full hour live on Friday morning. So we're very excited about that. So now that you know what's happening for the rest of the week, let's get to what's happening today. We have a wonderful panel. Let me introduce them to you, and we will get started. Jim Ketterer joins us, senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. I haven't been on the roundtable in a while. I was traveling. I was in Sweden for a week, and I think most people think about Sweden. They think about IKEA and ABBA, and all those good things. And
what you should say is when most Americans think.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe I should say that. But I was there giving some talks at the Stockholm School of Economics.
So Swedish meatballs, right?
And Swedish meatballs, the Swedish chef, I guess. All of that. So, but I was there doing something else, and it's a great institution, and I'm on the board of a program that's part of that institution. But I also had an opportunity to talk to some of the people in the diplomatic community, some people with some military connections to the Swedish military, and with political connections. And you know, Sweden is on the front lines of some really tough things going on right now. I mean, there are drones, Russian drones in Swedish airspace, including over Stockholm, on a regular basis. There are Russian military jets violating Swedish airspace. There are Russian submarines in their waters. There are cyber attacks. There is basically a hybrid war that is going on. They are reinstituting the draft. They joined NATO about 3 years ago. They are deeply unhappy with the U.S. statements on Greenland, the persistent statements on Greenland. They're deeply unhappy with current U.S. policy and Ukraine, and on and on and on. So I had a very, very interesting set of conversations and getting a view from that part of Europe as to kind of not only what's going on, but how they're kind of perceiving shifts in the world order at the moment.
Very cool. Welcome back. It's wonderful to have you back. Thank you very much for being here. Robert Pondicio joins us, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Joseph. How are you?
I'm well. Thank
you.
Good,
good. I had a interesting Saturday evening. I think I've mentioned this on the roundtable before, that I'm a volunteer firefighter in the little community of Medusa in the Hilltowns. And it's been a really quiet winter. I should knock wood. But yes, we had a call on Saturday, which... So shout out to my fellow volunteers. We stood around for many, many hours waiting for the power company to come and shut down a power line so we could extinguish a tree. This is the kind of excitement you get with a volunteer fire company. But more earnestly, there's a burn ban, which we should mention. This happens every spring. And those of us who live in rural communities are used to seeing our neighbors, you know, open burning. And when we get calls for volunteer firefighters this time of year, it's people who don't know that there's a burn ban. So the burn ban is in effect. I think it starts today and it's for about the next 2 months. So if you're burning out in the Hilltowns or elsewhere, you shouldn't be doing it at all, but especially not in the next 2 months.
Good point. In our town, we have a Smokey the Bear sign that has those dates on there of what we should know about. So follow what Smokey has to say. We welcome Libby Post to the program, political consultant, lobbyist, and our dear friend. Good morning.
Good morning. I've been seeing, I think, posts on Facebook and other social media about the need for more volunteer firefighters. That the it's really the ranks are thinning.
Yep.
Quite a bit.
Well, fire companies as well as rescue squads and EMTs and the like. So
And I think the average age is probably well north of 50 and maybe even 60. Yeah. So if you're a young person especially, we need you.
Yes, because so many, especially the fire companies, so many of these are lift calls
to get
people. And get some of the younger people. Right, exactly. Yeah. You know, and although they do a wonderful job. But,
by the way, a lift call, so you know, that's when we go out and assist EMTs. Somebody has fallen and needs to get picked up and put in an ambulance. So, we do a lot of those.
Yes, and they're busy. And you know, I think... most towns will have it on their board of how many calls they have in a given time. And I don't think I this is almost I think universal, but you go by and you're like, my God, it's only April and they've already done 220 calls. Like, good Lord. But it's they're very busy and they're doing a lot.
But this is why it's so important to instill the notion of community service.
Hear, hear.
Generation after generation after generation.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah, our fire chief is the third Ronald Case to be the chief.
Right. As long as he doesn't see it as his fiefdom, we're good.
I joked when I joined, do I have to change my name to Chase or Case? Because they're both of those families in our area have been volunteers for a very long time.
Well, that's a thing. That's good. But... yes, my brother was fire chief for a long time, and it's, he can tell you, it's very, very hard to get, especially young people, involved. So.
But very rewarding.
Kathy Sheehan is with us. Talk about volunteering. She volunteers to be on this program after being the mayor of the city of Albany, New York, and it's a great pleasure to have her with us. Good morning, Kathy. How are you?
Good morning, and I think that you could do an entire show on the policies and the economic reality that is feeding this need for volunteer firefighters. We live in a very different world. Many young people are working two and three jobs just to keep a roof over their heads. And so that's a reality. And then there have also been legislative changes that have increased insurance costs. And it's something that we used to lobby on when I was part of the New York Conference of Mayors on behalf of our villages, who very much wanted to ensure that they could continue this tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But it is incredibly challenging. And as I drove through some of those rural areas on my way to see a show in Pittsfield yesterday, I was struck by, first of all, the number of volunteer fire stations that I drove by that had the signs out front asking for volunteers. And the fact that, you know, as I drove, gas went from $3.59 to $3.69 to $3.79 a gallon. And so, again, just an example of sort of what we're up against when we're asking people to volunteer their time. There's the just the lived reality of where do they find the time when they're dealing with cost of living.
Well, Mayor, thank you for doing that, because as the, I'm the treasurer for our department, so I have firsthand experience with those insurance costs. You're absolutely right. They're skyrocketing.
And just as an aside to the insurance costs, I got a call last week from one of my members, an animal shelter that does humane law enforcement, and those premiums are going up. So it's like, you know, these are mostly volunteers who want to help animals and want to protect them. The humane law enforcement folks, they're peace officers, and not all of them carry, right? Some of them do, some of them don't. And yet the insurance costs to cover them are going up. And so I have one or two that are saying, well, maybe we'll jettison this because it's too expensive.
Right. Well, you see that in a lot of nonprofits, even homeless shelters and food pantries that have the same issues that they're facing. So, yeah, a lot to think about. Well, good morning. I was neglecting when I was doing the housekeeping stuff. Go Sienna. Oh my goodness!
Yeah.
Sienna is in the bracket for the NCAA and the what do they call that? March Madness. Thank you. And and I'm in a great deal of pain. At March Madness and they're going to play the number one seed in the entire country,
Ouch.
Duke. But good Lord. Congratulations for being in there. And wouldn't it be great if they just kicked their ass?
Yeah.
Like, how great would that be?
That would be awesome, especially because we're a Tar Heel family. My daughter went to the University of North Carolina. So, you know, there was this great book about Duke and UNC called To Hate Like This Is To Be Happy Forever. So go Sienna.
Yes.
Beat
well,
Duke.
I just have to say my daughter went to Duke.
All right.
So thank you, Robert. Well, we're off to a good start.
And my dad would just
see. Good thing I'm sitting between you two.
Yeah.
My dad went to Sienna, and I just, you know, so it's and it's in our region, and I and
yes.
of course the campus is very important to our show, and so I just wish them well. I think that's a great story, regardless. Okay, in other words, enjoy the next 3 days. That'll be fun. All right, let's get talking about what's happening in the world. We have a lot to talk about, and it was a relatively busy weekend as far as news goes. The story that struck me, it's sort of a look at where we are. Several reporters for the New York Times penned an article called Entering War's Third Week, Trump Faces Stark Choices. This is by many reporters, including David Sanger, Eric Schmidt, Tyler Pager, Rowan Bergman, and Julian Barnes. 2 weeks into a war against Iran that he chose to launch, President Trump faces a stark choice: stay in the battle to achieve the dauntingly ambitious goals he has set, or try to extract himself from an expanding and intensifying conflict that is generating damaging military, diplomatic, and economic shockwaves. He has quickly discovered that both options are deeply problematic, littered with consequences that he and his team downplayed when he plunged the United States, alongside Israel, into the biggest war in the Middle East in nearly a quarter of a century. He can continue to fight a weakened enemy that has nevertheless proved adept at extracting a fast-rising economic price for the United States and its allies, tying the global energy markets in knots and striking a dozen countries across the region. Battling on would put more American lives at risk, accelerate the financial costs, and risk further fraying alliances. There is angst within Mr. Trump's political base over the sharp departure from his pledge to avoid entangling the nation in more wars. Or he can begin to pull back. Even though most of his objectives, including assuring that Iran never again possesses the capability to produce a nuclear weapon, are not yet met, the biggest military accomplishments of the joint U.S.-Israel action so far, officials say, have been wiping out much of Iran's missile arsenal and air defenses and crippling its navy. The Ayatollah, the country's brutal leader for nearly 40 years, is also dead. But an emboldened theocracy is still in power, apparently commanded by the Ayatollah's injured son, who has already sworn to continue deploying Iran's asymmetrical capabilities, from cyber attacks to planting sea mines and conducting missile strikes on targets in the region. So this article, and that's just a portion of it, but the facing of these stark choices as you look at this, and we'll start with you, Jim Ketterer, of how we should go about trying to figure out which choice to make.
Yeah, that's an easy one. That's an easy question to start with. So I haven't been on the roundtable since the Iran conflict started. But I will say that I heard some of the roundtable while I was traveling. Shout out to WAMC. No matter where you are in the world, you can hear the station. So I'd be walking around Stockholm or in the hotel gym working out, and I could hear you all talking about it and talking about you know, the way the conflict started, right out of the gate, the lack of clear and sometimes conflicting objectives, the lack of the usual sort of kind of laying the groundwork of public support and congressional information and support, and a failure to coordinate with our allies. One thing that really strikes me about a failure to coordinate with our allies, so across the Middle East right now, across the Middle East and North Africa, what is in the State Department, the Near East Bureau, we have zero of our ambassadors in place. They were all removed unceremoniously a few months ago. These are career ambassadors, people who we generally, in these important posts, we don't put in political appointees. We put career ambassadors because these are people who are professional diplomats. None of them are there. There are, of course, people in their place, but it's not the same thing. And so those kinds of relationships are crucially important, particularly when you see the president saying, you know, we need assistance in reopening the Straits of Hormuz. We need assistance with this, that, and the other thing. We need coordination among the Arab states. That becomes much, much more difficult to do. And where we do have some political appointee ambassadors, it has created problems. I'll give you two examples. One is in France. So the French have sent an aircraft carrier to the conflict. The French have a long, deep and complicated and troubled history in the Middle East, but they're engaged. And our current ambassador to France is the father of Jared Kushner. He was convicted of federal crimes and then was pardoned by the president, and he's now our ambassador in France. He, just before this conflict, was called on the carpet by the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs for inserting himself in French domestic politics, and he refused to show up for the meeting. It's been a disaster. So this is unhelpful. The timing of this is unhelpful. Many of our American operations, very, very sensitive operations, are run out of our embassy in Athens because it's in the Eastern Mediterranean, but it's in a place that is easy to coordinate and still keep relatively safe, though it's a very tough post, and we usually put in career ambassadors there. Our current ambassador there is the ex-girlfriend of Donald Trump Jr. So coordinating these kinds of things, you know, it's not that diplomacy is somehow separate from having a conflict. These things have to work hand in glove, even more when a conflict is dragging on, even more when a conflict is not going well. One thing I also just want to say is, I know you all covered it, and it's worth saying, but it needs to be restated. This, of course, this regime in Tehran is a terrible regime. This is a very bad group of guys, and I say guys, it's really guys, who have been in charge since 1979. They essentially hijacked the revolution that was against the Shah, who was also not a good guy. Something to keep in mind, because mm-hmm. some people are saying we should bring the Shah's son back, which is absurd. So there's no doubt this is a terrible regime that has, you know, created many, many problems for American interests, for Israeli interests, for states across the region, and for the Iranian people. Just absolutely awful. But you know, we should cast our mind back just to not that long ago when we had the quote-unquote 12-day war, and President Trump then announced that we had obliterated all nuclear weapon, nuclear capacity. By the way, historically, it's also important to remember the first nuclear reactor that the Iranians ever got was from us. We gave it to them in the 1960s. When anybody happened to disagree with this idea, this assessment that the capacity was completely obliterated, the president was very upset. In fact, someone from the Defense Intelligence Agency put out an assessment that said it wasn't completely obliterated, and he was fired. And so now apparently it's not completely obliterated. And so that's one of the rotating reasons that we're back into this conflict. It was clear that the when people were rising up and President Trump was saying, you know, rise up against your government, help is on the way. Well, help wasn't on the way quickly. Many people were slaughtered by their regime. And that was unfortunate that he said that. But, of course, the main blame lies with the regime that carried out those killings. But it is a reminder of how absolutely ruthless this regime is. And many Iranians, and I'm in touch with people who, you know, really know what's going on inside Iran, and had a great conversation with somebody just recently about it, I mean, a day ago, about this. Many, many, many Iranians, of course, are happy to see anything, any outside force that could help bring down the regime, to actually change the regime, to get rid of this regime. But as this drags on the ground, regular Iranians not involved in politics, not working for the regime, and not activists, are turning against this as they see certain things happen. One, the bombing of the school. Not just that it happened, but the lying about it, in the wake of it, and the failure to take responsibility. If the United States had said, this was a horrible accident, we really are deeply, deeply apologetic about this, and we want to help each and every one of these families that's been affected by this, that would have been a very different take on what was said. A lot of the bombing that is going on is hitting residential areas, and it is, you know, when your residential area gets bombed, you have a way of kind of rallying around the flag, and there's a deep sense of Iranian nationalism, irrespective of how people feel about the regime. And also one thing that was, you know, maybe like a one news cycle story and went by for us, but is very much in the minds of Iranians, is the sinking of the Iranian Navy ship off of the coast of Sri Lanka. This was a ship that was mostly had cadets on it. They were coming from what was essentially a naval parade, and we could have easily boarded, captured that ship, offered everybody on board asylum, and if they didn't want asylum, we could at least treated them extremely well as POWs and towed the ship and kept the ship. Instead, we sunk it, and the president of the United States said, you know, it's fun to sink these things. He literally said, it's fun to do the sinking. So we sent 87 sailors to the bottom of the ocean, and Iranians are deeply aggrieved by this. And finally, when Donald Trump says that he should be involved in naming the new leader, this also is deeply offensive. And people say, well, this is our country. We've been suffering through this situation since 1979. We're not idiots. We should be involved in naming our new leader. So I feel like not only is the war going in sideways in many ways in terms of the battlefield, I think we're losing also the battle of ideas and for hearts and minds with the Iranian people.
Jim Ketterer, thank you very much. Glad you got to uncork all that. I can't imagine that being all for 2 weeks having to hold all that in. Kathy Sheehan.
Well, I think that, you know, looking at where this war is going and what Trump is doing, anybody who can figure out what Trump is going to do next, God love you. You know, he's going to feel it in his bones when it should be over the way that he felt that COVID would be over by Easter. So, you know, I've talked about how Trump has, you know, an incredible record of underestimating the challenge ahead of him. And this is another challenge ahead of him that he has completely and utterly underestimated, as Jim has laid out very clearly. I think talking about what this means to people who live in this area, who live in the United States, what this means for our families is, first of all, we have soldiers in harm's way and who have lost their lives or been injured. And so to our military families out there, again, we need to ensure that we are supportive of them and supportive of their needs, because as unpopular as this war may be, we cannot repeat the mistakes of the past. And so I just think it's very important to have those families and those who are fighting for us in the forefront, and we should be hoping and praying for their safety. And then I think about the impact on families who were already struggling. You know, we have a person who ran on and had many, many people vote for him because he said no new wars and gas below $3 a gallon. And we have a new war. We're all kind of on this roller coaster ride of we don't know when it's going to end or where it's going to end or what's next, because there doesn't seem to be a lot of rhyme or reason. It's just whatever Trump wakes up and feels like doing. And those who do assert themselves, as Jim noted, often get fired. So there's that. So woe to the person who does make any suggestion about how we potentially extricate ourselves from the situation that we're in. And again, for the average family, they're waking up to gas going up and up and up, which was the one bright spot in the economy. Mm-hmm. You know, we were seeing food prices inch up. We were seeing mortgage rates have now gone up again. And so all of this volatility for the average working family just makes it harder every day. And for those who are looking at those gas pumps, and I'm one of them, you know, I dropped my granddaughter off at daycare, and gas was $3.49 a gallon, and I thought, oh, I'm gonna fill up soon. And when I went to actually fill up at noon, it was $3.59 a gallon. That's a real hardship for many, 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 many people, and that is there will be a political, there should be a political fallout for that, and there needs to be an answer for it, and we're not getting it from this president or from this White House.
We're going to take a break. I want to hear from both Robert and Libby. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll hear from them, and we'll welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. The conversation continues after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. We started off, I was reading an article from the New York Times, entering war's third week. President Trump faces stark choices, and we've been talking about this with our panel. We've heard from both Kathy Sheehan and Jim Ketterer. Robert Pondicio, you're up.
Thanks, Joe. Let's get back to that New York Times article, because it was kind of a fascinating piece of journalism. A factor that I think was not discussed in that piece that I think is worth surfacing is that the information environment in this war is asymmetric. We talk about, you know, asymmetrical warfare. Well, the information is asymmetrical as well. Look, Iran is a closed society with tight restrictions on journalists. So we see very little reporting about the damage that the U.S. and Israel are inflicting inside of Iran. So by contrast, we see the effects of Iranian strikes in Israel or elsewhere in the region that are immediately visible and widely reported. I think that may, you know, alter the lens through which we're viewing this conflict. It creates an imbalance in how the war is perceived. You see, again, every successful Iranian strike, because those occur in open societies with a free media. You just don't see the cumulative effects. And my goodness, surely there have been cumulative effects of thousands of strikes carried out against Iranian targets. I also want to comment on something that Jim said. You know, he correctly, and I would argue, almost blandly described the Iranian regime as ruthless. You know, that's the understatement of the year. There was a terrific piece by my American Enterprise Institute colleague Matthew Continetti over the weekend in the Wall Street Journal. He makes the point that Iran's conduct in this war is exactly why it must be crippled. Yes, military action carries a price, he wrote, but I want to quote from his piece directly. He was referring to what he calls this Yosemite Sam strategy of Iran firing wildly in all directions. And he writes that it shows that diplomatic niceties are meaningless in dealing with fanatical authoritarian regimes. Iran's capability to damage, kill, and disrupt U.S. allies and partners is proof that its weapons are an intolerable threat, one tolerated for far too long. And I just think that's unimpeachably correct. So no one likes this war, but I'm sure this is not going to be popular among roundtable listeners, but I still don't see that we have any alternative. If not now, then eventually. This regime must not be allowed to possess nuclear weapons.
Libby Post.
Jeez. I don't know. I think if we had actual professionals in the diplomatic corps, people who really understand what diplomacy is about, how you when and where to saber rattle, right? To be judicious and strategic and understand the real dynamics that are going on. If we had that in this administration, we wouldn't be in the position that we're in right now. Yes, this regime is horrible. I'll agree to that. But again, it reminds me of when we used to try to do democracy building in Latin America in the 50s, and it always backfired. Always, always. Nixon was egged in a car, I remember reading when I was younger in social studies. But it's like we just can't go in there and say, you're going to do this, right? The idea that Trump was going to have any say whatsoever in appointing the new leadership was ridiculous and patently false, but just more ill-advised saber rattling when you needed some real diplomacy. So no one's backing down, because Trump won't back down simply because it'll be an affront to his masculinity and to his power. And he won't back down. Hegseth is even worse when it comes to those issues. And like, look, this is a man who wanted it to be called, who wants it to be called the Department of War instead of Defense. Right. And language matters and semantics matters. So it's we're in this. We're going to be in it for the long haul. And, you know, the other part of this is Robert talked about the media in Iran. Let's talk about the media here and the threat that the FCC chairman just delivered if they don't report the new, if the broadcast stations, ABC, NBC, CBS, the networks don't report the news. They like the way the news is reported, right? Their way, in terms of, you know, lauding the president.
Manner.
Right. Oh, that. Thank you. Lauding the president, patriotic. They're going to pull their licenses. I mean, you know, freedom of the press is, part of the Constitution. Oh, well, you know, so let's see what happens next. This is like one more step towards the fascist authoritarian regime that Trump wants. And it's not so much Trump, but it's the Heritage Foundation.
But I think that when you look at the fact that you have this horrific regime that was sponsoring terrorism and causing people to be brutally murdered and killed and slaughtered people in the streets for expressing their First Amendment rights and their discontent, all of those things are reasons why we should celebrate and want this regime to no longer exist. And that is why, and you step back and you build coalitions and you figure it out with your world leaders. You have diplomats in place who know what they're doing, who know the people, who have the relationships. when you think about how hard it is going to be to get to the nuclear material that we are supposed to be so frightened of, and I agree we should be frightened of it. We don't want them to have any nuclear capability. The complexity of that operation alone is not something that, based on anything that I have seen thus far, that either this military, the Israeli military, Saudi Arabia's, they're cheering us on. I don't know how the hell they're helping us. How they are going to execute that is, to me, something that every American should rightfully be saying, I'm not seeing this. You know, we told Great Britain, Trump told Great Britain 2 weeks ago, oh, don't send.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
Don't send a ship. We've already won this thing. I mean, this is not how.
He also then threatened them after. I mean, but he also laid in an insult to the Brits too, and then said, "We'll remember people who didn't support us
right.
after, yeah. or people who only support us after the war is won."
Robert,
I want to ask a question, and I promise I'm not being antagonistic. I'm earnestly interested in your answer here. Sure, diplomacy is great. Can someone please explain to me how we are supposed to use diplomatic pressure on this regime, which has shown no inclination to do anything other than pursue?
I'm talking about diplomatic pressure on the regimes around this regime.
Right. Okay, how would that change the outcome?
You have Saudi Arabia, who has been pushing and pushing and pushing. What have we asked of Saudi Arabia? What skin do they have in this game? I feel like the United States is being a proxy for them. And they're the ones who are going to benefit from a weakened Iran way more than the United States is.
All of them will. Okay.
All of them will. So what does that look like? Who are the leaders in the region who are going to come in and be part of a future Iran that is not a horrific regime of oppression? And for Trump to be arrogant enough to think it's the United States, when there is a long and disgraceful mm-hmm. history of the United States intervening and making huge mistakes in this region, similar to in South America, we need those partners in the region who are going to shore up a new regime in Iran. And I don't see where we've done that.
With respect, Mayor, if I may, I agree with you, but I'm not hearing the answer to my question.
I have an answer to your question.
Okay, great. We're agreeing that we do not, that a nuclear Iran would be intolerable. Well, then how do you achieve that outcome?
So we don't have to ask the question, how would we do it? We could say, how did we do it? So we have a specific example with Iran. During the Obama administration, it was a combination of very hard-nosed and very focused diplomacy on nuclear weapons.
The JCPOA.
Yes, specifically on nuclear weapons. And a combination. So you can say, well, it wasn't a perfect result, but I disagree with the idea that, because for the listeners, you're rolling your eyes.
I don't mean to be emotive.
But,
I'm sorry.
But the
it's okay. It's radio.
Diplomacy is never going to give you a perfect result. That's why you go through negotiations. But it was a combination of sanctions. These were multilateral sanctions that were in place for a very long time and were highly effective, and really is the only way that sanctions are ever effective. We often say we're going to do sanctions here and we're going to do sanctions there. It's highly performative. It's usually counterproductive. But those sanctions really did work, and they weren't just Obama sanctions. Those sanctions had been in place for a long time and had included a lot of people. So that's one piece of it. That requires not just diplomacy, it also requires enforcement. Mm-hmm. And we and the world enforced these sanctions over time. So that was helpful.
But my concern with the JCPOA, the so-called Iran nuke deal from 2015.
Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action.
I can never remember that acronym. Thank you, Joe. Is that it would have expired in 2025.
Yes.
With no oversight whatsoever.
So
and correct me if I'm wrong, it was predicated on the idea that through sanctions relief, we could incorporate Iran into the community of responsible nations.
So
where did we ever get that idea?
But wait a second, Robert. So what you're doing is you're saying you want an answer to the question.
Yeah.
I'm giving you an answer to the question. You say, well, you don't like the answer, I'm saying it's not it wasn't a perfect result. What we're going to get now is a much, much less perfect result. Hmm. When Donald Trump undid the JCPOA, mm-hmm. he did it with no other plan, mm-hmm. no other mm-hmm. idea as to what to fill in the vacuum.
That and was so, in 2018.
Right. So between 2018 and now, the Iranians have had a lot more time to do a lot of bad things that they wouldn't have had the plan stayed in place. And so the because there were all kinds of things that would kick in if they were just free to do whatever. And I also think that the Biden administration is to blame for also not taking this as seriously as it needed to be taken. And so but all that having been said, whatever the imperfections of that deal happened to be, and I agree that there were imperfections, whatever the blame then was of Trump 1.0 and the blame of the Biden administration, how is this kind of, talk about a Yosemite Sam sort of operation. This is, I mean, I'm not sure that we can just say that it's the Iranians who are the Yosemite Sam. We don't have a clear plan of battle. We don't have a clear battle plan.
We have a time warning, but go
ahead. But I mean, and anyone out there who thinks that this administration under Pete Hegseth's leadership and Donald Trump's leadership have any clue how to bring regime change and eliminate the nuclear threat that Iran has, I think, has not been paying attention. I have zero confidence in their ability to be able to execute this in any way that is going to be ultimately successful.
All they want to do is blow things up.
We're going to break for about 5 minutes, but don't worry. This panel will be as feisty as ever when they return. Don't you worry. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And don't worry, they'll save it for the radio. They'll be nice to each other during the break. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. A good conversation going. Jim Ketterer is here, senior fellow the Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Robert Pondicio, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. A lot of senior fellows this morning.
Old men is what that is.
Political consultant.
Guilty as charged.
Lobbyist Libby Post and the former mayor of the city of Albany, New York, Kathy Sheehan. We have letters. Does anybody want to make any points that were outstanding prior to us going to letters? All right, then, here we go, off to letters, and in a minute we're going to go into a more detailed discussion about what Libby brought up as to the FCC and Chairman Carr. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Ray says, thank you, Libby. We need professionals all the way from the top down. The MAGA party seems to believe that anyone can step in and run the country. Mm-hmm. Case in point, Mark Wayne Mullen running the DHS. What kind of nuts make these decisions? And that is from Ray. We'll maybe talk a little bit about Mark Wayne Mullen a little bit later on as well.
Oh, we should.
Joe, could I say something else in response to that letter, too? One of the reasons to be relying on professional diplomats and others at this time, too, is that this really is turning into a regional war. What's going on in Lebanon is really intense and spinning out of control. At the same time, you know, you have the Houthis in Yemen, which the Biden people and the Trump people have not been able to really fully mitigate. And so tanker traffic through the Red Sea and through the Suez Canal has been heavily affected for both of these administrations. Syria is very fragile. The role of Turkey in all of this. You have the Gulf states. I mean, the regional aspects to this are very, very serious and need to be very carefully managed.
Why is the region so unstable, Jim? Remind me.
Why is it so unstable?
Yeah. Isn't it Iran?
Oh, Iran certainly has been a major focus of that, and yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that that is one of the reasons. That's not the only reason that we could have a very very long series of conversations about why the Middle East is unstable. There's a long list of reasons, but yeah, the Iranians are at the top of the list of stirring that pot.
Mm-hmm. We go to, intentionally or otherwise, it seems Trump's war has exacerbated. This is from Eric, I'm sorry. Intentionally or otherwise, it seems Trump's war has exacerbated the religious schism in Islam, given the large population of Shiites in several Sunni-majority countries. Is the war likely to destabilize nations relatively friendly to the United States?
I mean, it has that possibility. I think generally people oversimplify the Sunni-Shia thing, and they tend to see, like, all Shia are on the side of the Iranians and all Sunni are in some other side. And anytime somebody gives you a simple explanation of what is going on in the Middle East, stop listening to them. Yes. I'm not saying the letter writer is doing that, but I'm saying that many people do that. They say it's all about fill in the blank. Whatever the fill in the blank thing is, they don't know what they're talking about. And so, but that is one issue. There are states in the Gulf that have larger Shia populations, or like the Saudis have a large Shia population in the one area of Saudi Arabia that happens to be the oil-producing area. So it's an issue, but it's a complex issue that's part of many other issues.
This from Jim. We don't live in that area. Why are we the cleanup in aisle six folks? Why can't the neighbors band together to address this? It's not like many of them, like Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE, are poor. Seems like the other Middle East countries are more than willing to let the U.S. and Israel do their dirty work. Anyone on that?
I just, this notion that people not understanding why this isn't going well. We have a president with the mindset of, I'm great at making deals, and you're going to capitulate to everything I say. And he might have been able to manage something like that in business, but you can't do it in diplomacy and in running a government. So this shows that running government like a business does not work. It would be nice if the other countries in the region would step up, but we're doing it for them because this administration can't stand not being at war.
Well, I think that the first Trump administration, they did keep a number of the career professionals, and he got frustrated with them and didn't like what they said. So, you know, it'd be like saying, you know, I don't really like the way that doctors treat patients, so we're just going to toss all the doctors out of the hospital. And when I have a heart attack and now I need stents put in, they're this orderly watched a doctor do that a few times, so let's give it a whirl. I mean, that might be a terrible, but it's what it feels like. There are the professionals who would sit down and say, here is how, because Jim, correct me if I'm wrong, but this entire war game is sitting on a shelf, right? I mean, the State Department.
Every war game you can imagine is sitting on a shelf.
Right. Yes. So the State Department and really smart people who've worked on this and know the people and know all of the things that you're talking about, Jim, would say, okay, we bomb Iran. Here's what happens next. And here's what happens next. Here are the partners that we need at the table. Here are the countries that we need to bring along. Here are those, you know, he's the president is threatening other countries, saying we will remember who helped us for a war that he didn't tell any of them about and didn't even attempt to, based on what we can see and what we've heard, doesn't even appear that he attempted to create any sort of coalition. And so I think that's what's so frightening about this, is that these are complicated and perilous times. They require a level of professionalism, and we have a president and a populist who has convinced many, many people that the professionals don't know anything, and it's just going to be what I feel in my bones.
But, you know, the letter writer does, I think, ask an important question about why is the U.S. just perpetually engaged in the Middle East? And many American presidents have come into office asking the same question, presidents from both parties. And I worked in the Clinton administration, and the Clinton administration very much wanted to find a way to get less engaged in the Middle East. George W. Bush came into office, and then 9/11 changed that. Barack Obama talked about the pivot to Asia, but and on and on and on. And Trump first administration also was trying, and I think it was a sincere effort to also disengage from this kind of, you know, police operation of to be the cop of the Middle East. And it's every time a presidential administration tries to do it, it's like that scene from, is it Godfather 2? It just keeps pulling me back in. and they, so this has, the letter writer has hit on an important question that is on the minds of every single president in the last several decades. And they find themselves back in it and back and meshed in it.
Iran is our enemy. It's not just the enemy of its neighboring states in Israel. Iran is our enemy.
Oh,
and
yeah,
has been for 50 years.
They took our embassy and held our people hostage. I know two of those people personally who were held hostage and who were tortured. And so, yes, and there's many other things that have happened. They are operating counter to U.S. interests, to put it mildly. There is no doubt about that. But there's a lot of Americans who start that history in 1979, and Iranians have a longer view of history, and they also remember the things that happened at the behest of the United States that undermined the legitimately and democratically elected government of Iran. So, again, there's no single answer.
All right, back to the letters we go. And we welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. Why is Iran our war and Ukraine is not our war? I ask this because Republicans decided that Ukraine wasn't our war and they sabotaged our support for Ukraine. Now these same Republicans are beside themselves with glee over the war in Iran. That from James. We go to Chris, who says, killing the 86-year-old leader of Iran instead of letting nature take its course to allow a possibly more moderate successor to emerge made no sense. Also, the war started while Iran was still negotiating with the U.S. regarding their nuclear capacity. Why didn't we bring in serious seasoned negotiators to try for a workable compromise before resorting to military force?
It is a good question to ask, why would we have Jared Kushner, who holds no actual position with the United States government, and Steve Witkoff, why would we have them simultaneously negotiating on the Iran deal, Ukraine, and Gaza? We have a lot of really, really smart professionals who know each of those areas and have deep knowledge and experience.
It's called money.
Yeah.
It's the bottom line here. It's just called money. That's why. They've already greased their own pockets. They've already brought in billions of dollars. You know, it's prime real estate. It's on water. I mean, you know, a lovely hotel would look nice there, don't you think?
Gaza.
Yeah, well, Gaza or Iran, right? But it's all about money for Jared Kushner, for his dad, who shouldn't be in any kind of diplomatic position, right? I mean, this is what it all comes down to. We will see when this 4 years of insanity is over just how well these people self-funded themselves using taxpayer dollars.
Moment of silence, we go to Bob.
No, I was just going to ask Libby to connect those dots for me. You clearly know more about this than I do. I mean, what was it? What about their negotiations?
Every time when Jared Kushner goes across the ocean, there's a deal cut.
Okay.
It's just the way it goes. And it's not a deal.
Give me details. I'm not familiar with this.
I can't give you... I read the headlines.
Okay.
Another deal cut, another deal cut. I'm not going to give you chapter and verse. I'd have to go and do a little research because, you know, my brain isn't as good as it used to be.
There is a great New York Times article that lays out the billions of dollars that have gone directly to the private entities owned by the Trump family.
Oh, no, no, no.
From Saudi Arabia, from all of these countries that he travels to.
I was just asking about the specific negotiations in these three hotspots. Libby seems to know more about it than I do.
No, I'm not saying that, Bob. I'm just saying if the pattern exists and it's going to continue to exist until Trump is out of the White House.
Okay.
All right. Just for a point of order, I was saying Bob, the letter writer. I would call you Robert and call the letter. And I don't know. I didn't know I was allowed to call you Bob.
In education, we call that cold calling. I thought you were cold calling.
No, that's very true. I didn't know I was allowed to call you Bob.
Well, I just.
Do you go by Bob?
I generally don't, but I respond to every possible permutation.
Well, don't say that on the show. Good God.
Yeah, you never know what's going to happen.
We'll called a lot of permutations.
Yeah, we'll go. we're going to go with Robert. But Bob wrote in and said the only thing Trump proved was that his administration is just as incompetent as the Bush, Obama, and Biden administrations that preceded him in foreign policy. Robert, not our Robert, but another Robert, asks about our Robert, who said, did Robert just completely ignore the fact that there were ongoing peace negotiations being discussed? That's when you decide to bomb a country unprovoked? Am I living in the Twilight Zone? Yes, Iran is a country that is potentially dangerous, but unjustifiable. Attacks are never the solution. You create a coalition of nations to put diplomatic pressure to achieve goals.
The point I was trying to make, and maybe I was inarticulate, I often am about this, is where what is the source of our faith in diplomacy with an unreliable negotiating partner? There's nothing in 50 years of experience with this regime that should lead any of us to believe that they will honor any deal, that they can be trusted to stick to a deal. So at some point, when do you just kind of face up to that fact?
I think when you have told the world that you have eliminated their nuclear capability. And so when you look at the bombings that occurred where the president said, we've eliminated their nuclear capability, I believe that most Americans, most people around the world would think that that would be the height of our negotiating power and our ability to get a deal done. And so that, I think, is why many people are scratching their heads and wondering why the hell we are where we are right now.
Mm-hmm. And if you and Robert, I can definitely see the line of argument to say, okay, these are bad actors in every way, and negotiations just aren't going to work, and we're going to have to use force. Okay, if one is going to do that, then the question is how, why, and under what circumstances. Then you have really very serious decisions to make. It's not just kind of use force in some kind of general way. You need a specific plan of action. And you need to follow the lessons that we've already learned from the many mistakes we've made in that neighborhood, with that country, and with their neighbor, Iraq. And, you know, we've learned a lot of what not to do, and it appears we're making many of the same kind of mistakes. And so, and also following a lot of what seems to me either no advice or bad advice. So if we're going to use force, let's do it in a way that is smart and effective, and not have a Secretary of Defense saying, like, well, we're not going to be, you know, we're not going to be constrained by rules of engagement. We're going to be, you know, we're going to be focused on lethality and not legality and these sorts of things that, number one, you know, are kind of dog whistles to a certain part of the political base, but have no bearing on an actual plan of action. And so that's what's needed. You need to take this very seriously and have very serious objectives and learn the lessons from our immediate past of mistakes.
All right. We'll pause there as far as letters go. Then I want to go to this, as I was mentioning a moment ago about the FCC. Brendan Carr and the threat that Brendan Carr laid down this weekend to broadcasters criticizing the Iran war coverage that came over the weekend. The president has now endorsed Brendan Carr's warning to broadcasters. President Donald Trump on Sunday endorsed Federal Communications Commission Chairman Brendan Carr's threat to revoke broadcast licenses over news coverage of the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran, calling media organizations corrupt and highly unpatriotic in a Truth Social post. They get billions of dollars of free American airwaves and use it to perpetuate lies, capitalized, in both news and almost all of their shows, including the late night morons who get gigantic salaries for horrible ratings, Trump wrote. As I used to say in The Apprentice, fired, he added. Carr, in his Saturday, which is different than taking away a license, by the way, but Carr, in his Saturday post on X, warned he would deny or revoke government-issued licenses if broadcasters run what the agency deems fake news. The warning was the latest salvo from the official who, since becoming FCC chairman at the outset of Trump's second term, has relished the role of media enforcer. Broadcasters that are running hoaxes and news distortions, also known as fake news, have a chance now to correct course before their license renewals come up. Carr wrote on X, "The law is clear. Broadcasters must operate in the public interest, and they will lose their licenses if they don't." Carr said changing course would be a savvy business decision for broadcasters, though he did not mention any by name, given trust in legacy media has now fallen to an all-time low of just 9% and our ratings disasters, unquote. It's unclear what trust metrics Carr is citing, but Gallup found in 2020 that 9% of Americans have a great deal of trust in mass media, though another 31% they had said they had a fair amount of trust. When a political candidate is able to win a landslide election victory after in face of hoaxes and distortions, there is something very wrong, Carr said, presumably talking about Trump, who received 312 electoral votes and 49.9% of the national vote in the 2024 presidential elections. It means the public has lost faith and confidence in the media, and we can't allow that to happen. Time for change. Now, I know that this is my business, and this is where we live here. So to me, I find this about as frightening as it gets.
Okay. Yes. Yes. But look, it is fair, obvious, I think, to say that threatening media outlets and talking about revoking broadcast licenses is not healthy rhetoric coming from the administration. Okay. But the former civics teacher in me wants to say, at the same time, you've got to separate the rhetoric from this pesky little constitution that we have. I mean, you just can't do this, okay? Revoking a broadcast license because of a political disagreement is obviously unconstitutional. It would not survive 5 minutes in court. So I don't want to sound blithe about this, Joe, but in an adult, mature country, we say, well, obviously that can't happen.
Okay, but what about what was done, let's say, as of in 6 weeks, Stephen Colbert is going to be off the air. And that was a power play. The same thing with.
Yeah, but you're not persuaded by the idea that CBS was grateful for the cover to get him off the air and stop losing how many tens of millions of dollars?
No.
Okay.
No. In fact, I don't think that's true. Oh, I think yeah. I think it is a healthy franchise that has made money and would continue to make money.
Okay.
And quite frankly, if it wasn't making money, they would have taken it off a long time ago prior without the political pressure. Mm. However, also, and then there's Jimmy Kimmel, and then not to mention, oh, don't forget what they did to public broadcasting. So if now you're going to say we're going to take away all public broadcasting's funding, and then on top of it, if you I'm just saying this, this is not this is just a let's say a scenario I'm sorry I missed the news again, Bailey. I apologize. I promised Bailey. Bailey, is it wait, second week or third week? Third week? Second week. And I've already missed the news twice.
It's initiation by fire.
Yeah, I just...
It's my fault, Joe. I wound you up.
It's my apologies. My sincere apologies. Because I make a lot of mistakes on that show. I don't usually make that one. But I apologize. Well, I'll make it up to you in a minute, I promise.
Can I make a point of order, though, Joe?
Yes.
Which is that the First Amendment is sacrosanct funding for public broadcasting. I love NPR, too, but that's not a constitutional obligation.
I understand that, but if you are trying to eradicate those radio stations, the next step then is for a network, NPR, that, just ran a story about the Epstein files that indicates that there were however many pages that the president of the United States was included in that seemed to appear to indicate a possibility that he had sex with a 13-year-old, that maybe that could be labeled, I don't know, fake news by this administration, in which case those broadcast licenses would be looked to be pulled.
How did you feel about the previous administration's disinformation efforts?
In what? Give me an example.
I'm going to play the Libby card. I can't cite you the exact the site, but there was a disinformation czar that the Biden administration hired at one point. I can't remember her name.
I don't remember. I never got a letter from the disinformation czar.
Okay.
Was this part of the effort to counter disinformation from foreign adversaries?
Nita
Jankowicz was appointed in April 2022 to head the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's short-lived Disinformation Governance Board designed to combat misinformation threatening national security. Following intense criticism and online harassment, the board was paused and soon dissolved in August 2022. But again, that the board's aim was to recommend best practices to combat disinformation. That's different from pulling licenses.
Oh, I agree.
And I think that your standing on the Constitution for many of us is almost laughable when you look at the Supreme Court and the basis of some of the decisions that have been made. I think that there are people who justifiably have serious concerns and are quite skeptical of whether or not we have a Supreme Court who will feel as, I don't know, strongly about the power of the First Amendment to prevent licenses from being taken away for reasons that we would all, I think, find appalling.
I have to tell you, I remember Dan Rather reporting from the fields in Vietnam, and his reporting is part of what spurred us getting out, because nobody really knew what was going on. If Johnson had ever thought about revoking those licenses and giving those words, air, he would have been more throttled than he already was being throttled, which wasn't one of the reasons why he didn't run for re-election in 68. And so now we're saying, oh, don't worry about it. This is a man who only wants messaging that's positive about him to be out on the airwaves, in print media, on social media. And, he's authoritarian. He's a fascist. He wants total control of the media. You know, he looks at Putin and thinks, and the guy in China thinks, gee, they could get to control their media, and I'm a big boy just like they are. Why can't I? This is what we're dealing with.
You know, I'm glad you brought up Dan Rather, because I also think that these problems, if there is fake news, that often they can take care of themselves. Dan Rather, after 44 years of working in the field for CBS, left under rather bitter circumstances because of a fallout with the network due to a report on 60 Minutes, 60 Minutes 2, to be exact, about President George W. Bush's National Guard service. And it was found to have some real flaws to its reporting. The point is that the network took action to that. And that is what I think should happen, as opposed to the government making the mm-hmm. making the distinction as to what is fake and what is real, and pulling a license and saying that you can't publish or print whatever, or yeah. you know, broadcast whatever. Right. You want.
I mean, what other business would the administration get into the fine details of to destroy? You know what I'm saying? It's like, who else are they going to go after? Are they going to go after other hotel chains? Are they going to go after Marriott because Marriott said, screw you, we're doing DEI. Sorry. Are they going to start going through those, going after those companies?
But I think
those
that that's
too?
Where, you know, the Constitution doesn't matter here. Ultimately, you know, Donald Trump has wielded economic power and threats in ways that are having the impact that he wants and that is mm-hmm. impacting how news is getting reported and whether stories are run or not.
Look what's
it's
done.
Already it's yeah. already happening. And I think that that's why, you know, when you look at what Donald Trump has done, right, he's supportive of putting limits. And this was a story that we were going to try to get to, but putting limits on members of Congress' ability to buy stock.
Correct.
Right. He was supportive of that, but yet he pardoned mm-hmm. an insider trading, because he wants to use that power the way that that benefits him. And so I'm going to have these rules in place. And if my friends break the rules, that's fine. I'll pardon them if they really get into a jam, but I'm going to use them against my enemies. And
you know,
that's who we elect. That's who got elected president in the United States.
I'm sorry, Robert.
No, in a previous job in my adult life, I was the public affairs director of a couple of different national magazines of Time and Business Week. So I would answer these questions for a living. I was involved in press controversies professionally. If I'm still in that role today and somebody calls me for a response in the story, I'm literally going to say, see you in court. But the other point I want to make is that, one, every president does this. Every president tries to control the media coverage of them. What about Obama here, who had eight? I'm looking at Google here because I wanted to get my facts correct. The Obama administration prosecuted national security leaks more than all previous presidencies combined. Under Obama, there were 8 federal prosecutions of government employees and contractors for leaking classified information to the media, which has a more chilling effect on journalism. This kind of silly, broad pronouncement, we're going to pull their license, or that, where you're actually threatening journalists with jail.
Okay. Well, we have to take a break because I promise, Bailey. But also, I mean, well, we'll talk about it on the other side. Bailey, if you want to, we're going to talk radio talk for a second. If you want to put the 39 and the 45 together, and then we'll be set to the top of the hour, that would be great. Over to Bailey. Thank you. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Thanks to Bailey for bailing me out, and I appreciate that. And we are here discussing the idea behind FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr's decision to want, I shouldn't even say decision, I should say threat, for want of a better term, to look at the stories that are coming out and regarding the war, and having the stations that broadcast what they deem to be fake news and pull those broadcast licenses. So this is it is a threat, and to broadcasters criticizing Iran war coverage. Right before the break, Robert made a point that I think is a good one about you were bringing up Obama and about whistleblowers and about leakers. And prior to that, you had said that all presidents have tried in some way to have a handle on the press and what they report. I think that's true. But I also think it's true that all presidents are also trying to handle leaks within their administrations and trying to keep the I just watched The West Wing, and they had a whole episode on it. It was very powerful.
Riveting.
So I do think there's that. But to me, there is a difference, a very big difference in a broadcast license and why we broadcast news that if and then what you consider to be news, because now the president is lumping in late night programming. Is that news? Is that entertainment? And do you pull the license because it's unfair? And then, yes, you do get into free speech issues. I agree with you.
I just don't see any scenario under which this is a credible threat. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong.
It'll be a little too late.
Jim?
I just was wondering, and this is a real question. It's not a leading question. How many people really get their news from... like the network news anymore. I just don't know. I'm assuming it's a small number and it's older people.
Yes.
I'm assuming that that's it.
No.
But
the younger cohort's getting it from TikTok and other social media.
Right.
Feeds.
Well, I mean, because when you were saying, Joe, like, well, what's news and what's not news? You know, is if when Colbert tackles an issue or John Oliver or something, I think that's getting a lot more eyeballs than CBS Evening News.
And people may not be aware of this, so we should make sure they know. The FCC only controls what goes over the public airwaves. So cable, internet, print, not subject to FCC jurisdiction at all.
That's one thing we can agree on. Okay.
But that makes it almost sillier, right? Because you can't, because you have access to this information quite readily.
Otherwise, yeah.
I mean, if you were to pull, God forbid, if you were to pull WAMC's broadcast license and we were to continue doing this show as a podcast, you still would have access to the information.
Yes.
It would not be broadcast and would not be as readily available to people as it is.
You know what I don't know, Joe?
By the way,
you do?
All our listeners, young and vibrant.
Yes.
What I don't know is when broadcasters repurpose, like, you know, we listen to the roundtable online, on the internet. Is that subject to FCC control now?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
So it's not
the content.
Yeah.
It does make me think that, and there probably are people who are pondering this, but it's just coming to my mind now. So maybe there ought to be a really serious rethink about, well, what is the whole licensing process, justification? You know, is this really for a media that existed from times of yore that doesn't exist anymore, and it's only one slice of it? So, you know, this doesn't answer Brendan Carr's outburst and bad behavior, but it just does make me think, well, really, what is the purpose of this whole process?
It's a really
now?
Good point. It's kind of like, you know, applying rules for the railroad in the 19th century to all of transportation. I'm guessing a vanishingly small slice of our information ecosystem goes over the public airwaves.
It's like when we redid the city code in Albany, because you could open up a telegraph office, but you couldn't open a bar on Lark Street without getting like seven variances.
I'm gonna
It's like that.
But the other part of this
Could you open up a telegraph office that serves booze?
The other part of this, though, is that if they take away their broadcast licenses, they can just go to their streaming services and have the news.
But my point is that might be where they're consuming it anyway.
But it's also the declaration of who is going to who is going to decide what is fake news and what is not fake news.
Right.
And if you have reporting that is being done that shows that this happened and the administration said no, it doesn't, as Gavin Newsom says, if Trump doesn't like your coverage of the war, his FCC will pull your broadcast license. Well, that may be an oversimplification. However, maybe not.
But this president has undermined people's confidence in every other source of information for his entire prior term, for the 4 years that he was out of office, and since he got back into office. So that's his MO. And I think we need to just say that out loud. If he doesn't like what you're saying, he calls it fake news.
Right.
If he doesn't like you, he calls it fake news. If he thinks that you voted for a Democrat, he calls it fake news. That's his shtick.
But
it's
Mayor,
what he does.
That's why I'm less concerned about this, and perhaps I ought to be, because I just view this. Occam's razor says to me, this is just pure politics. You know, Trump's base hates the media. This is red raw meat for his base.
Understood. I still find it reprehensible.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. No disagreement there.
Carr, I mean, this is a person who has evoked condemnation from free speech advocates for pressuring Disney's ABC and its affiliates to take comedian Jimmy Kimmel off the air, expanding his equal time rule to cover daytime and late night talk shows, launching investigations into numerous media companies, and overseeing a lengthy merger review of Skydance's purchase of CBS's parent company, Paramount, that included the network appointing a conservative ombudsman to review content. A bipartisan group of SEC commissioners, including chairs from both parties, petitioned the agency in November to repeal its news distortion policy, a rarely used instrument that has been at the heart of Carr's media campaign, arguing that even without enforcement action, the specter of government interference alone chills broadcasters' speech. At the time, Carr said the petition was quite rich, coming from people who, he said, censored conservatives. A spokesman for Carr did not immediately respond to questions about whether Carr's remarks were targeted at specific broadcasters. Trump spent much, but you know what I find interesting about that, too, of specific broadcasters? When Pete Hegseth set his own rules in regards to the press room at the Pentagon and had people sign on, the networks that you would expect that would be friendly, Fox News, didn't do it.
Yeah.
They said, we're not doing it. We're not signing on. Now, this isn't a choice in this case. This would be that if you found it to be fake news, that perhaps they would be as possible for them to lose their license as it would for another broadcast entity to do so. The other thing, too, I would just like to throw into the mix, too, I believe, and I have to look into this because I don't know, stations have licenses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Networks do not.
I think that's right.
So it's that's another issue here.
Yeah.
So if you look, because even when the Kimmel thing was
they
going on, we
affiliates.
Were talking about they were going after the affiliate stations. So
right.
That is another issue here. And then are you going to treat them all the same if they show, broadcast, or air the same material? And in other words, of being an affiliate, let's say, to NPR, if NPR makes them mad, would they come after us because of that? Or would they just come after us because of what we've done?
They would pressure you to put pressure on the
mothership. On NPR,
yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just so we all know, the Fairness Doctrine from the FCC was repealed in 1987.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when anybody says, well, we got the Fairness Doctrine, well, that's just not true, because as someone who does the work that I do, I know that the Fairness Doctrine is not in play, because there are radio stations, TV stations who skew their reporting based on whether they're red or blue in red or blue areas, right? So let's just be clear about that. And then, you know, the what they were talking about, what they do have, I guess, is an equal time rule that requires stations to give equal time to both sides. So I'm not quite sure what the difference is, but the fact of the matter is...
Well, the equal time also is in regards, this is what was debated over
Kamala Harris.
Oh, this is about candidates.
Yes.
The equal time rule is just about candidates. So that's why they took Tellerico off and blah,
right.
blah, blah.
But again, it has always been on news programs, not on
yes.
entertainment programs.
Right.
Which is why the Tellerico interview was removed from CBS right. by CBS's lawyers and then put on YouTube instead. The other thing mm-hmm. I'd like to mention is that I think when we talk about also chilling is, at least I find this chilling, CNN chairman and CEO Mark Thompson was quite concerned, saying, "We stand by our journalism." This after Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth complained over the weekend about what he called fake news from CNN over a report indicating that the administration underestimated the war's impact on the Strait of Hormuz. He also said the network would improve once Skydance Paramount chief David Ellison, whose pending purchase of Warner Brothers Discovery includes CNN and requires Trump administration approval to take it over. Okay.
Right. This is why, again, the First Amendment isn't the issue here. Yeah. It is the Trump administration's use of money to get what it wants.
Wasn't also Pete Hegseth and his staff, didn't they say this past week that they would not allow the Washington Post reporter to come back into the press room because the secretary did not like the photos that they took?
Yeah, there were several photographers that were removed as a result of the unflattering photos that were taken during the second press event that Hegseth had after the war was after the war began.
Well, they're so fragile. I mean, I've never met or seen a group of men who are more fragile about the way they look and what people say about them. I'm just so sorry that they don't have what they need to really be in this business, because they don't. If you're in politics, you need to have a tough outer shell. You need to let things slide off of you. You need to recognize there are various players here.
I think we have somebody here on the round table who knows.
Yeah,
that.
Right. Well, I'm looking at it when I'm saying it. Yeah. We work together. Yeah.
I just want to also mention that David Ellison, speaking about the Warner Brothers deal that includes CNN, said that he pledged to maintain CNN's editorial independence.
Now, yeah. Whether CBS or CNN?
CNN.
CNN.
Oh, yeah, I have a bridge I'd like to sell you.
Okay. but again, when you have the Secretary of Defense then saying, well, the sooner the better that Ellison buys CNN so we don't have to worry about this anymore, so that information is taken.
You know, they think the oligarchs are going to take over, which is what they want. And that they'll take their marching orders from the administration.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that the thing that he was ticked off about that CNN reported that the Trump administration underestimated the Strait of Hormuz. Yeah. If he's suggesting that we didn't, and so we knew that this was going to happen, and that we were going to see this huge spike in oil prices, and that this was going to, you know, cripple, you know, people's ability to get oil. No, we knew that. Like, you can't have it both ways. You know, now he's calling for help, literally ringing the bell for help from other countries to help reopen the Strait of Hormuz.
Also, I don't want
total incompetence.
I don't want to get my journalistic friends in trouble, but CNN wasn't the only one to report that story. I mean, you know, that was out there from many other outlets. I don't know.
And we didn't talk about it earlier when we were talking about Iran, but it's worth also, since we're talking about the Strait of Hormuz again, there's a lot more that comes through that strait than just oil, the liquefied natural gas, but also aluminum. It's one of the This area of the world, one of the major producers of fertilizer and other goods. I mean, and all of the petrochemicals that go into the products that are made from things that are. So it's not just at the gas pump. This is going to have a widespread effect on the economy, and it's hard to just kind of get it up and running easily again.
We are out of time. I want to thank Jim Ketterer, Robert Bundisio, Libby Post, and Kathy Sheehan for sharing with us this morning. I thank you very much for your comments, for your time, and for your brilliance. It's very nice to have you all here together. A good, vibrant discussion.
Thanks, Jill.
We also, a reminder that coming up next, we will have a special broadcast of Afropop Worldwide Celebration of Women's History Month, and that will air in just a few moments. And we welcome you to listen to that excellent program. My thanks to our producer, Sarah LeDuc, to Madeline Reynolds, our associate producer. Thanks, of course, to our panel and our wonderful engineer, who is really patient, Bailey Janes. And coming up after the Afropop special, we'll have Midday Magazine as well. All that and much more. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.